Dr. Jeff Ripa is on the other end of the line. Hey, how are you this morning, Doc?
Hey, morning, Tom. Doing well, and I love this weather.
Yeah, so do I. I really do, especially in the mornings when I get some time, quiet time alone and nice, cool weather. That's a pretty nice way to start the day. So I got to thank the doc. I got a personal lesson in telemedicine. I got kind of sick while I was on the air. It's been, a couple of months back. And I send my symptoms and a photograph to Dr. Ripa, and he's like, "Oh, where's your pharmacist? You need some drugs, buddy. Here's." I need to thank you for helping me out like that, Doc.
You're welcome. To give people my background, I practice in Murfreesboro, and when COVID restrictions happened, we shut down basically and went to doing entirely telemedicine and medicine through video initially until we kind of figured out how to see people in the office safely. And there's a big learning curve there. I think I, like most physicians, kind of figured out quickly that there are a lot of conditions that you can treat perfectly well over the phone, especially if you've got somebody who's tech savvy and knows how to send you a video or a photo of something, and other things were a little more challenging.
That was my takeaway too.
It's been a welcome new challenge, and at other times it's been difficult.
That was my takeaway too, Jeff, was that, you know, once you saw a picture and I told you my symptoms, you're like, okay, here's what we're doing. And I thought it was effective and quick, and I was really happy to be able to get the help and get back to work very quickly. Didn't really leave work, but it was just a little uncomfortable for a few days, so thank you. But it also was a lesson in you can do it for me, right?
Yeah, I hope that's some good that comes out of this pandemic, is that we healthcare providers have sort of been forced to use telemedicine. And, I mean, I think we've always had the tools and resources available to us. It's just we're comfortable seeing people in the office. So, you know, like anybody, we get a little stuck in our ways. But it's been kind of nice, you know, especially for some people that have kind of chronic health issues that need to be checked in on a little more frequently, realize that a phone call a couple times a week is a pretty quick way to do that.
And, I've noticed something else, Doc, and I'm curious about this. Sometimes people aren't self-aware when it comes to their bodies and changes, and they're confused about how to communicate that. That's not been a problem for me, but it shouldn't be. But other people, I do notice that. And the reason why I mentioned that, I was on the phone with my dad last night after he'd had glaucoma surgery. And I was like, I don't know if it's cognitive or whatever the case. I know he's not listening, so, because he's not that tech savvy. But I noticed that in trying to get from him the information that I needed, that there was a communications barrier, and I assume you see that on all kinds of different levels.
Oh, absolutely. So, some people you almost have to see in person because you kind of need that physical presence to drag the information out of them, and you can learn a lot about somebody watching them walk down the hall sometimes. Other people, not so necessary. If someone communicates well like you do, it's easy to get the information out.
So let's talk about COVID-19. You know, there was a time where we were sitting and waiting for it to happen, and it didn't seem to happen. Well, now it's happening in very real senses here right now. How many patients have you personally treated, Dr. Ripa?
Yeah, I stopped counting some time ago because it was happening in waves. So in Murfreesboro, I personally have had in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 patients who have had COVID. And these are just patients. So, I mean, I know of other people, acquaintances, friends, you know, people in the community. But we're just talking about my medical practice. 35 to 40 patients. I've had one patient die of it. I've had one patient who's looking like will wind up being permanently disabled from it. That person darn near died, and just the disease has sort of wrecked their lungs and their strength. That's probably the saddest story that I have coming out of COVID, is a person who was middle-aged, healthy, working in a sort of a job that was strenuous labor, and looking like that person will likely never be able to go back to work again, struggling to pay the bills right now because, you know, the process of getting on disability takes a little while, and just kind of a sad story.
All right. And what's the spectrum on ages in your experience?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. You know, at the start, the region-wide trend was that we were seeing people kind of all ages. There's definitely a wave right now. I know you've mentioned several times on the air this morning that there have been numerous new cases and two new deaths. I guess the little bit of good news to come out currently, I've got several patients who are currently active cases, but the good news is they're all young, in their 20s and 30s. So, you know, I think that they will all recover. None of them have had to go to the hospital or anything like that. you know, the death rate and the hospitalization rates locally have dropped a little bit over the past couple months, because it seems like younger people are a little more likely to not follow social distancing guidelines, a little more likely to congregate in groups, which means they're a little bit more likely to get COVID. But the good news there is they're also more likely to recover. So as we see this kind of wave moving through Southern Illinois right now, the good news is that we're seeing primarily young people. But the problem is those young people are spreading it to some older people also.
You and I have been talking for a number of years about the flu. You and I, every flu season, we talk about the flu because I want to hear what you have to say in your front line of experience. This isn't the flu. This has these circulatory issues. I have a friend of mine who is currently hospitalized, day 8, COVID-19. And one of his symptoms, when the ambulance finally got to him, his bottom of his feet were blue or black in circulation, what's being called COVID toe. He described just in the first day where he got it, that there was a concrete block on my chest. They haven't intubated him, but they're using some kind of positive negative where they put the face on a BPAP, CPAP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
CPAP
and use that.
Yep.
Right. I mean, when you start learning more about this, I'm curious, age, sex, and symptom spectrum. What are you looking at?
Well, so the older somebody is when they get COVID, the more likely they are to get sick. That's not a terrible surprise. You know, that's kind of how diseases work in general. But people who tend to go to the hospital and who get very sick tend to be a little bit older. People that have diabetes are more likely to get sick. People that have kidney issues are more likely to get sick. It's pretty well all the risk factors that you would typically think of for somebody who's going to be sicker. You said we talk about the flu, and one of the things I see, you know, a lot of people kind of say, well, isn't this just like the flu, or we don't make such a fuss out of the flu every year. I have never I've been in Southern Illinois practicing for 13 years now. Maybe the worst flu season that I've seen here. I had 2 to 3 people in the hospital with it. I'm happy to say I haven't had anybody die of the flu since I've been practicing in Southern Illinois. I've diagnosed up to 15 to 20 of my own patients in a single year with the flu. But COVID, you know, like I said, 40 of my own patients, one has died. I've had, I don't know, 7 or so in the hospital. I mean, that it doesn't even come close to even a bad flu year. This is just much, much worse, even in my own practice.
You were talking about the person who was at the debilitating circumstances from COVID-19, did they have an underlying problem that led them down that road, or was just their response to the disease?
Correct. Just their response to the disease. A generally healthy middle-aged person.
Didn't really have emphysema
kind of
or
medications or anything.
No,
really just bad luck.
No emphysema or anything like that?
Nothing.
That's pretty that's pretty creepy.
Yeah, kind of scary. And several other of my patients who have been hospitalized actually had no underlying health issues either. You know, just couldn't keep their oxygen levels up, which is one of the kind of hallmarks of this disease when it starts to get severe. So if somebody gets COVID, most people are just going to run a fever for a week, feel kind of miserable. They're going to cough. And that one actually does look a lot like the flu. So some of those comparisons are fair. But where it gets to be unfair is a very high percentage of people that get COVID start to get this high level of inflammation in their lungs that can make it impossible to get enough oxygen in, which is what leads to hospitalization. So I've had several healthy people kind of in their, you know, 30s, 40s who have had to be hospitalized with this.
Well, I'm curious. You said inflammation of the lungs, and I often think of it as bodily fluids that constrict the pathways. Is there a difference, or am I just...
Yeah, so what actually happens in people that get really sick with COVID is they develop this syndrome that's called ARDS, Adult Respiratory Distress Syndrome, or Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome. What actually happens there is the little membranes inside the lungs that oxygen has to cross over to get into the bloodstream. So this thin little membrane, think about it as being almost like a tissue, and things have to be able to pass through it. It gets thicker. And when it gets thicker, it gets more difficult for oxygen to go in and carbon dioxide to go out, and then you can get some inflammatory response and a little bit of fluid. But the primary issue is that the lungs just get a little too stiff and a little too thick, and the barrier becomes too hard to get through.
And so the alveoli is what swells up?
Yeah, so the alveoli, the tiny little pockets in the lungs, they kind of function like tiny little balloons. When we breathe in, air goes into the alveoli. And again, they have a very thin lining, and the oxygen has to cross through the alveoli. But
right.
The lining of the alveoli gets too thick. That's what ARDS is.
It was interesting. In one of my classes, the teacher had exemplified the surface area of the lung, once it was laid out flat, was about the size of a tennis court. It's hard to imagine the surface area of the human lung that interacts with the environment is so large. But the reason why I use that, it's a good mental tool. Imagine the tennis court is nothing but human flesh, and now imagine it just one film, and then imagine it being added on by an inch or a quarter of an inch, where, you know, that constriction there. If they're swelling in that location, and that, imagine a tennis court being folded up and put in your chest. That give you an idea of the surface area. So, treatment. What have you seen that has been effective? Is it fight the symptoms, or is it fight the virus? What's the stance?
Yeah, so the treatment is, you know, at the same time, it's very complicated, but at the same time, it's not very complicated. It's mostly supportive, right? There's really only one drug that has been proven that it works. It's an antiviral, and it's all but impossible to get a hold of because it's not a medication that was necessarily being mass-produced because it was kind of a specialty medication only useful for a couple of infections. So I don't, to my knowledge, that's not being used locally just because I don't think we can actually get a hold of it. So when we say supportive care, it's things like giving oxygen to help people breathe, maybe anti-inflammatories to some degree to help keep their temperatures down. If they have massive inflammation, sometimes we'll use steroids for that. But, I mean, there's no really specific treatment. When I say no specific treatment, compare that to, say, a urinary tract infection. If somebody gets a urinary tract infection, we don't just say, okay, you're going to take, you know, this pill to keep a temperature down or this pill so that it doesn't hurt when you have to go to the bathroom. We give antibiotics, and there's kind of a list of three or four antibiotics we use, so that's the specific treatment for that. Unfortunately, coronavirus, COVID, doesn't really have any specific treatment available to us that works.
All right. Now, this, and people are already texting me about hydroxychloroquine. You know, now, this is a subject that is literally a tinderbox right now of discussion. It shouldn't be a tinderbox. We are talking about science here, what you're reading on this treatment. And I think the treatment I saw mentioned, I think it was, there was also some type of antiviral drug and hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, so hydroxychloroquine, old drug, has been around for a long time. It was, I don't remember why it was developed exactly, but it gets used to treat malaria and lupus are kind of the two things for which it works. And we don't use it a ton for malaria because there's better, safer drugs for that. For lupus, unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of safer stuff that gets used. But to a physician, it's sort of frustrating that the myth of hydroxychloroquine working doesn't die. Let me talk a little bit about, I guess, what scientific method is first. So in medicine, people have hypotheses all the time, not opinions. An opinion is different. A lot of people say, well, I have an opinion that this drug works or that drug works. In science, you can have a hypothesis. This drug is going to work for this condition, but then you have to test that drug and say, does it actually work for that condition? So somebody at the start of kind of the COVID pandemic had a hypothesis and saying, hey, maybe hydroxychloroquine works, and gave it to a few people who recovered, maybe because of the drug, maybe not. At the start was kind of the thinking. But then as more and more studies have come out, and there have been three or four big well-done studies, they've shown that hydroxychloroquine just doesn't work. And a couple of the studies have even suggested that maybe even increases your risk of dying. So one of the problems that we see here is it looks like if you give hydroxychloroquine to, say, 100 people with COVID, best case scenario is that it will do absolutely nothing. It's not going to increase your chances or decrease your chances of dying. Worst case scenario, though, is that you might kill two additional people with the drug. That's a big deal. When we're talking about, you know, 157,000 deaths in the United States from COVID or something like that right now, and had everybody with the COVID gotten hydroxychloroquine, you're talking about up to an additional 3,000 to 4,000 deaths from that drug. So that might, you know, 2% might not sound like much, but add that up over the whole population, that's a big deal. And so the best science that we have right now on that drug says it just it doesn't work. And I think anybody who's giving it is committing malpractice, honestly.
Well, but you, at the same time, you can go out and find someplace, a Yale epidemiologist who says it works. And then that gets shared on social media and people stand on that rock.
Yeah, so the Yale epidemiologist published an article in Newsweek, and here's the issue. He cited only one article, and it was an article that he had written. And I think that guy is guilty of ego. I say that because when a scientist comes up with a new treatment that seems to work, there's a certain amount of prestige that comes with it, and honestly, some monetary opportunities to speak at conferences, be paid to make appearances, that kind of stuff. So there is some pressure on scientists to come up with a treatment that works. So I think this guy is kind of falsely pushing the claim that it works, and he's ignoring all the science that's to the contrary of what he wants to believe. And honestly, I mean, Newsweek should know better also. You know, have they done a little bit of research, quickly see that the science that this guy is touting is not good.
Yeah, it's interesting because that article came out July 22nd, and then by July 29th, the Yale School of Medicine had a very strongly worded statement concerning that article as well. Here's another one, and I hate to throw this a non sequitur, and I know you're not a pediatrician, but I'm having difficulty learning something about something, and I want to see if you are hearing this too. My evidence is purely anecdotal. I've been talking to parents who are preparing to take their kids back to school. They've been taking their physicals, and the doctors have been sharing with some of the parents that I know that they are not really treating sick children right now. They didn't fall down and break their leg, right? They're, you know, they didn't get hurt with a piece of fireworks or whatever it is. That the children that they're seeing in their office now, anxiety and fear to the point where some are even advising that the children start taking medication to be able to deal with this mental stress that they've been enduring. Have you heard these stories? Have you heard any evidence to support that outside anecdotal evidence?
I have definitely seen, I wouldn't necessarily say that specific to children, but to rephrase, the pandemic has not done good things for anxious people in general.
Right.
So some people that sort of struggle with anxiety to begin with, you know, now you have all these issues that are going to be anxiety provoking, even in those of us that don't really have that issue to start with. And, I mean, kids pick up on the moods of their parents. So if all of a sudden parents seem more anxious, more nervous, routines are being interrupted, that kind of stuff, of course they're going to be a little bit more anxious too. You know, I think sometimes we don't give kids enough credit for being smart and for being impressionable. You know, kids, they're sponges, man. They'll pick up what's going on around them. So if they're going to be around adults who are constantly fretting and worrying and panicking and nervous, of course they're going to pick up on some of that and kind of learn to model that behavior and to feel that way also.
And, you know, when it comes to screen time, the kids don't hear it. I mean, I was actually part of one of those. I was over at a friend's house and, you know, realized some of the material we were talking about. Their, you know, granddaughter was in the back. I'm like, oh, gosh, gee whiz. What does she think about this, right? And it was interesting because you could see a certain solemn look on her face. She's young. She's getting ready to go to school for, I think, her second year, right, school. And it's weird because you can see it. You can see if you bother to look. And they're just a bundle of emotions inside, you know, inside some very thin skin. So you mentioned sponge, but all the adult emotions with none of the tools for dealing with it, they don't exist yet there. But all the feelings do.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of I have four kids, by the way, ranging in ages from 11 up to 17. And I have never been the touchy-feely parent. It's just not my style. I've been very matter-of-fact. You know, kids, here's what's happening. Sorry, you're going to have to figure out how to deal with this, but this is what's going on. This is what we're going to have to do. So, I mean, I would just encourage parents to, you know, tell your kids what's happening, but at the same time, matter-of-fact, put it in such a way that they're not going to panic, but in such a way that they're going to be careful.
So be honest with them.
Yeah. Be honest. Don't withhold. It never works out well to lie to your kids. Eventually, they figure out the truth, and it doesn't do good things for that relationship.
Jeff, I know you for the type of person who likes to stand up on their tiptoes and look and see just if they can get just a little glimpse over the horizon. If you had a footstool today and were looking over the horizon at COVID-19, what do you think you would see?
Man, I hope that one of these vaccines is going to work out. And there's a few of them that are looking pretty promising. So what my hope is that we continue as a society to tread water, meaning, you know, we continue to social distance, to wear masks, to, you know, avoid congregating in large groups, and basically continue what we've been doing for these crappy last few months, but with some hope on the horizon. Because if one of these vaccines works and works well, and within, you know, a couple months of that coming out, we can get a good chunk of the population vaccinated, this is all going to get much better. You know, and I there's some hope there right now. So, you know, a couple of different companies, Oxford University, the drug company Pfizer, another group that I'm not coming with off the top of my head, all have vaccines that are looking pretty good so far.
Moderna, maybe?
Yeah. So if even one of those works out and works out well, get it manufactured, get it distributed, get people to get the vaccine, this goes away. I mean, that I can't stress how much that is the answer. If one of those vaccines works really well and we get enough people to get the vaccine, the pandemic's done. It's defeated. That's how we defeat, you know, infectious diseases that ravage our populations. You know, if you have something like the bubonic plague where there's no cure and there's no vaccine and nobody really understands what's going on, the way that it goes away is everybody who's susceptible to it dies, right? So 500 years ago, that's what happened in Europe. We don't live in those times now. We know what's going on. We know how to beat it. We just have to get a hold of it. So I would tell anybody who's getting, you know, tired of this, I'm tired of this. Hold on. There's actually hope on the horizon.
World Health Organization director said this morning there may never be a vaccine.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fear would be that a vaccine doesn't work or works only temporarily. That would be defeating. and that would be, you know, depressing, because then there's not necessarily an end in sight.